Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Off the Sidelines, Raise Your Voice, Change the World is the title of the new memoir by Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, the Democratic senator from New York. She will be in Albany on Saturday at 4 p.m. at the University at Albany Campus Center Ballroom for a reading and a book signing. In the book, she calls for a new women's movement, one that includes greater participation in everything from the PTA to Congress. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Senator Kirsten Gillibrand to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Did you write this book specifically for women?
I did. I really wrote it as an intimate conversation among women about the issues we care deeply about. It's part memoir, part self-help. It's a bit of a call to action, asking women to be heard on the issues that they care about. And what I really believe is if women are heard, whether it is in their PTA meeting or in their community group or at their law firm business meeting, that the outcomes will be better because women have a different worldview, a different perspective, different life experiences. And when they're heard, more issues are raised, more solutions are offered. And the combination of those male and female voices together are more powerful.
You talk about it being a part self-help book. What was your self-help guide in getting you through those moments? What was your self-help?
Well, I talk a lot about the importance of mentors and role models, and I had some amazing role models in my family. I learned so much from my mother and my grandmother just growing up around them. My grandmother, as you might know, was a bit of a salty character. She never went to college. She was a secretary in the state legislature, worked from the time she was 20 years old. And she believed that women's voices really mattered. And so she organized women in her community to get involved in politics. And together, they really had an impact on who got elected, what their positions were, what they were fighting for. And my mom, she taught me how important it is to be exactly yourself, that it's okay to be different. It's okay to strive to achieve big things. She was only one of three women in her law school class. And the way she managed us kids and her job was really beautiful. I just remember her talking on the phone, and we had a very long phone cord in our kitchen where she'd be working on an adoption case while she's cooking dinner, while she's sweeping the floor, all the while, you know, looking after the us kids and seeing what we were doing. And I just remember how important it was for her that she found her own way. And, you know, she was different in a lot of ways. She, by the time she was my age, she had a second-degree black belt. So she was somebody who truly did be exactly herself.
How much of it was a wake-up call? I mean, obviously, some of the headlines that have come from the book have been how other senators have treated you and so forth, and the sexual politics that exists in Washington and in the world at large, of course. But I'm interested in how much of a wake-up call it was for you when you grow up in a house with those role models and an expectation, perhaps, that is the way of the world?
Well, I think for any woman in my generation, I'm 47, any woman 40-something was told there's nothing you can't do. You can do anything if you put your mind to it. We were the first generation that really achieved academic parity, and today, in fact, more than half the college degrees are women and more than half the advanced degrees are earned by women. And so we as a generation, I don't think, assumed we'd be fighting the battles that our grandmothers and our mothers had already won. But when you begin to get into higher levels in your career and you begin to see impediments or real structural challenges like no affordable daycare or no universal pre-K or not even equal pay, you begin to wonder, huh, I guess there are some challenges out here that I didn't expect. Interestingly, we are the only industrialized country in the world that doesn't even have paid leave. So at those family emergencies when you're juggling the new baby or when you have a child who's very sick and needs that 24/7 care or your mom's dying, those are times we need flexibility. And women are often ramping off their careers to meet family needs because we want to and often have to, but not being ever able to ramp back on where you left. And for the woman who's a low-wage worker, she may well lose her job if she misses a day because she has no sick days. She has no vacation days.
I know you've thought a lot about this, but can you answer the question as to why that is, of why we've reached a point where that's even acceptable?
You know, it's interesting. We've been having these national debates now for quite a while. We've been watching the NFL completely disregard the value of women and how they deal with domestic violence. And it's the same institutional bias we're seeing over and over again, where large institutions with enormous power protect their self-interest first. And often that means the star football player or the star soldier or the star student. And they close ranks. And oftentimes the person who is disbelieved or blamed or doesn't see justice is the woman. It can also be men, but it's often the women. So one of the reasons why I fought so hard on sexual assault in the military and sexual assault on college campuses, and I've raised my voice on this NFL issue, is that women are important and we should value one another. And if we do, if we paid women a dollar on the dollar and truly valued them in all things, we'd have a stronger country and we'd have a stronger economy.
When you have a case, let's just take the NFL as an example, and there's a lot of blame to go around there. There certainly has been a lot of talk. When you have a statement from the victim in this case, Ray Rice's wife, who then is defending her husband and saying that the media is intrusive, what does that do overall to the message, and how does it muddy the waters in having that conversation?
Well, I really focused on the NFL's behavior because they're the ones who know all the facts. They knew that Ray Rice had beaten his wife because he said he did. They knew that he dragged her out of the elevator in a very disrespectful way. There were no facts left to be determined, but they still gave him a slap on the wrist. So my focus is much more on what are these institutions doing to hold people accountable. And the conversation needs to be about the abuser, not the abused. We need to talk about the perpetrators who are committing these acts of violence, these acts of assault in a Department of Defense and college campus setting, rape on campus, sexual assault in the military. And it's the institution's behavior and how they are protecting the status quo and not seeking justice, which is really problematic because it goes to this problem where, again, institutions are devaluing women and devaluing the survivor. And that is something that I think we need a national debate on.
You talk about appearance in the book. You have a chapter, and much has been said about sexist comments and so forth that were made. Did you see that as much in the House as you did in the Senate?
I think it's a universal struggle. And the reason why I include those anecdotes and illustrations is to elevate the debate, to talk about the larger point, or what are the challenges that women face in the workplace. And I particularly included stories from when I was younger. I included a story about when I was a young lawyer and worked my tail off on a case for months and months and months, many long evenings, canceled vacations. And in the celebratory dinner, my boss talks about, and now Kirsten, she's done such an amazing job. And don't you just love her haircut? Don't you love how great she looks? It was a punch in the gut. It was really harmful because I was young and I thought I had worked so hard and I didn't understand what my hair or looks had to do with my performance. I felt devalued. I felt that the work I put in didn't matter. And I want a young woman reading this book to know she is not alone. And if she's in a circumstance that she can't do anything about, that she can push through it, she can overcome it, she can become a partner herself someday and change the culture of that law firm.
This week, the New York Times reported that the center, you had never released the name and mentioned the name, and the New York Times reported this week that it was Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii who has since passed. And the thing that struck me, I know there was a lot of political talk about that, but the thing that struck me was, if true, that there was also an age difference. And I'm wondering, did that enter into your mind, or to you, doesn't it matter? I mean, I guess the question is, you were talking earlier about how women of your generation were the same age, that women of your generation are being told that they can do anything. Do you think we're aging out? I mean, this man, the senator, was in his late 80s when he would have said this to you. So do you think we're aging out? I mean, is there optimism there?
Well, you know, for me, it may well be a generational difference, but you know, I'm at a point in my career where a comment like that, it doesn't affect me. It doesn't undermine me. It doesn't make me feel less confident. I can look at it and say, that's a really outrageous or stupid thing to say, but it doesn't hurt. The reason why we need to have a national conversation about it is because there's a lot of women where a comment like that would very much undermine their confidence or make them feel that they are not valued or feel very objectified. And so the reason why you elevate this kind of conversation and not talk about the individual is because it is a universal problem and a a cross-generational problem. It happens in many settings, in every industry. It is not particular to any one profession. And so it's all about this larger issue of how do we support women in the workplace? Well, number one, pay them equally. Number two, don't objectify them. Number three, help them meet the needs of their families by giving them flexibility. Those are all things that can make a huge difference. But it's truly the low-wage worker whose boss is harassing her that is very damaging because she doesn't necessarily have a choice. She may not be able to speak back. She may not be able to blow it off. She may feel threatened or undermined or unsafe. And those are the instances and concerns that I have that we need to have this debate about. That's what's most important to me.
20 women senators on the Hill. How much of a force do you think you are collectively?
I think the 20 women in the Senate are very powerful. I'd like us to be 51 because that would be parity.
Right.
But 20 does do a great deal of good. And you really saw it on display during the debate on sexual assault in the military because every single one of the women senators wrote a piece of legislation or helped to write a piece of legislation that would make a difference. Now, even 17 out of the 20 women supported the most aggressive reform, which was I was championing, which was taking the decision-making out of the chain of command to remove the bias, to make it more objective and to make justice possible. But what we see and what my personal experience is, and this is one of the gifts I think women often bring to the workplace, is sometimes we're very good listeners. Sometimes we are very good at finding common ground, very good at building consensus. And my own experience in the Senate, any time I've ever passed a piece of legislation, I've had a strong Republican woman helping me. So whether it was Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal and Susan Collins was leading the charge, or whether it was fighting for the 9/11 first responders and the women of the Senate, Lisa Murkowski, Olympia Snowe, Susan Collins, were not only strategizing with me about how to get that bill passed, but going into their cloakroom, talking to the Republican colleagues and saying, why aren't we standing with first responders? That mattered because we ultimately passed that bill unanimously. So I feel that we make an effort. We have these quarterly dinners that Barbara Mikulski started some 20-something years ago when there were two women in the Senate. And what those dinners provide is an opportunity to get to know each other as people first, as women, as daughters, as mothers. And it's exciting because we care about each other. We want each other to be successful. It doesn't mean we're a monolith. It doesn't mean we're going to agree on everything.
Right.
But it does mean we have more of an interest to leave the partisan bickering at the door.
Do you think Barbara Mikulski will get her due eventually? This seems
She's having her due.
Barbara Mikulski is
the chair of appropriations. It's the most powerful job in the Senate.
No, I know that. But I mean, like,
on
the world stage, you know, here is a woman who has just been a trailblazer and has been incredible. And yes, yeah, so you certainly hear about it in her job, but getting the accolades for being the trailblazer that she has been.
Well, I certainly admire her, and all the women of the Senate admire her, and so we celebrate Barbara Mikulski's leadership all the time because she is an amazing trailblazer. But I hope people write some books about her because she's accomplished so much. She's a wonderful leader. She's definitely been a role model and a mentor to me. When I was first appointed, she had me come to her office, and she told me, you know, how Washington works and how do you make sure you get good things for your state and how do you fight for them best. And she had such good advice about how to do our jobs. And she's always encouraged me. Every one of these issues, from sexual assault in the military to Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal, she was always cheering me on and saying, Kirsten, keep fighting. You're doing a good job. And, you know, that means a lot to someone who's been doing this for a long time and really knows how to get things done.
You've been doing events for this book all over the country, in Nashville and in Dallas and Philadelphia and Boston and, of course, Washington. And you'll be in Albany on this Saturday. So this is a homecoming. You're going back to your old stomping ground. So that must be something you're looking forward to.
I'm really looking forward to it. My parents will be there and a lot of my cousins and family members. So it'll be a lot of fun. And I love being home. So I'm really looking forward to it. I think it'll be a great conversation.
Senator Kirsten Gillibrand's new book is Off the Sidelines, Raise Your Voice, Change the World. It is published by Ballantine Books. Senator Gillibrand, a great pleasure to have you on the program and look forward to seeing you in Albany on Saturday. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I hope a lot of people bring their sons and daughters. It's a great opportunity for them to ask questions, too.
Terrific. Senator Gillibrand, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book is Off the Sidelines, Raise Your Voice, Change the World. It's published by Ballantine. Senator Gillibrand will be at SUNY Albany on Saturday at 4 p.m. at the University at Albany Campus Center Ballroom for a reading and signing. To find out more information, you can go to bhny.com, bhny.com, for more information. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.